part of being better with our money, whether it's saving or spending or investing or how we plan for the future, depends on how we're able to manage our own tendencies. And in today's episode, our own money habits. Gretchen Rubin is an expert on helping you or helping us identify, and then she does this in four separate personality tendencies, how we respond to our own expectations. And that's either our own expectations from ourselves or the expectations externally from our family or work. And if we can learn how to better manage ourselves, we can apply it to our own finances and our own retire sooner journey. In today's episode, we also talk about money and happiness, and Gretchen Rubin shares with us the one thing that you need to do when it comes to landing at the intersection of money and happiness. I'm Wes Moss. The prevailing thought in America is that you'll never have enough money, and it's almost impossible to retire early. Actually, I think the opposite is true. For more than 20 years, I've been researching, studying, and advising American families, including those who started late, on how to retire sooner and happier. So my mission with the Retire Sooner podcast is to help 1 million people retire earlier while enjoying the adventure along the way. I'd love for you to be one of them. Let's get started. Welcome to the Retire Sooner podcast. It is a great honor to be able to interview Gretchen Rubin, who I know has been an inspiration. Gretchen is an expert on, I would say, getting better at executing on your habits.
Yeah.
Right?
Well said. Yes.
By having kind of a better understanding of what works for you. Yep. And she's the author of Better Than Before, The Four Tendencies. Obviously, everybody knows The Happiness Project, her show. It's Happier with Gretchen Rubin, yes, yes. Which I'm also a big fan of. And, you know, she sold 3-4 million books. She dominates what I would call, and I only know this from you, Gretchen, is is creative nonfiction.
Ah, I love creative nonfiction. Yes.
I've never heard of that from anybody except for you. So I guess that's what I've been writing, I guess, in that same genre. It's like, it's nonfiction, but it's creative. So I guess that's what you do.
Right. As opposed to something like journalism or academic writing or legal writing or yeah.
So if you can, because you're the expert on understanding habits, I think I just wanted to start with, as an example, happy retirees, we've done a lot of research on this in different surveys. They have 3.6 core pursuits, which are hobbies on steroids. The unhappy group has only 1.9. Happy retirees take 2.4 vacations. Unhappy group takes 1.4. So we've got a lot of these different habits. And I wanted to ask you first, start with the main pillar of a lot of your work is these four tendencies. You have a book that's titled The Four Tendencies. I love your quiz that I'll link to, and I've taken the quiz. So maybe if you can just start helping our audience understand themselves with these four tendencies.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're exactly right. The four tendencies is something that could be enormously powerful in helping people understand how to set themselves up for success. Because the kind of thing that would work for one retiree might not work for another retiree. But often we feel like, what's the best way? What's the right way? If it doesn't work for me, there's something wrong with me. Instead of saying like, oh, if this doesn't work for me, I've learned something. Now let me try a different way. And so the four tendencies is meant to help you identify what's most likely to help you be successful instead of just throwing spaghetti against the wall, as we often do. So the four tendencies look at a narrow but very significant aspect of our nature, which is how we respond to expectations, which sounds super dry, but ends up being really juicy and really helpful to know, both about yourself and also if you're dealing with other people because you understand how to work with them better.
So how we respond to expectations.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So that's a little bit abstract. So think of it this way. We all face two kinds of expectations. Outer expectations, like a work deadline or a request from a neighbor. Inner expectations, like my own desire to keep a New Year's resolution, my own desire to spend more time fishing. Depending on how we respond to outer and inner expectations, whether we meet them or resist them, that's what makes us an upholder, a questioner, an obliger, or rebel. Now, I'm going to explain them right now. And once you know them, they're super obvious. Like, we could do the Game of Thrones characters. they're not subtle. And so I think most listeners will know what they are and people in their life right away. But you mentioned there is a quiz at quiz.gretchenrubin.com. It's a free quick quiz. Like 3 million people have taken that quiz. So if you like to like take a quiz and get an answer, you can take that quiz.
By the way, when I took your quiz, I kept saying, I thought it was hard. I was like, gosh,
that gives me an insight into what I bet your tendency is. Well, hold on to that. We'll keep up. It's a little teaser.
I'll let you.
Okay. We're going to have a reveal. Okay. So it's how it's upholders, questioners, and bludgers, rebels. So upholders readily meet outer and inner expectations. They meet the work deadline. They keep the New Year's resolution without much fuss. They want to know what other people expect from them, but their expectations for themselves are just as important or more important, which can kind of make themselves seem cold sometimes. So their motto is discipline is my freedom. They like to-do lists. They like schedules. They like to execute. Then there are questioners. Questioners question all expectations. They'll do it if they think it makes sense. They resist anything arbitrary, ineffective, unjustified. They don't like a New Year's resolution. January 1st is an arbitrary date. Why wait for January 1st? Do it right now if it makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. They tend to love research. They tend to love customization because they want to make like the most justified, efficient choice. So they're making everything an inner expectation. If it meets their inner standard, they'll do it no problem. If it fails their inner standard, they will push back. So their motto is, I'll comply if you convince me why. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then there are obligers.
And by the way, are those two of the bigger categories or are they spread out?
No,
they're not.
I'll describe all four and then I'll tell you because you put your finger on something important. So hold that thought.
Okay.
Then there are obligers. Obligers readily meet outer expectations, but they struggle to meet inner expectations. So I got my insight into this tendency when a friend said to me, look, I know I'm happier when I exercise. And when I was in high school, I was on the track team and I never missed track practice. So why can't I go running now? Well, when she had a team and a coach expecting her to show up, she showed up no problem. But when she's trying to go on her own without outer accountability, she struggled. The key, the essential element for obligers is if they want to meet an inner expectation, they must have outer accountability. It is not self-care. It is not priorities. It's not putting yourself first. It's not getting clear on what you want. If you want to read more, join a book group. If you want to exercise, work out with a trainer who's charging you, work out with a friend who's going to be annoyed if you don't show up, take your dog for a run who's going to be so disappointed if he can't go for his run, think of your duty to be a role model, raise money for a charity, outer accountability. So the motto of the obliger is, you can count on me, and I'm counting on you to count on me.
Okay.
And then finally, rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They want to do what they want to do in their own way, in their own time. They can do anything they want to do. They can do anything they choose to do. They want to put themselves and their identity out into the world. But if you ask or tell them to do something, they are very likely to resist. And typically they don't tell themselves what to do. Like they don't sign up for a 10 a.m. woodworking class on Saturday because they think, I don't know what I'm going to feel like doing on Saturday. And just the idea that someone's expecting me to show up is going to bug me. So their motto is, you can't make me and neither can I. So to your point about how big are the tendencies, the biggest tendency for both men and women is obliger. You either are an obliger, you have many obligers in your life. That's the biggest tendency. Then questioners. That's a big group of people, questioners plus obligers. Rebel is the smallest tendency. It's a conspicuous tendency, but it's a small tendency. And my tendency, the upholder tendency, is only slightly larger. And these are kind of the two extreme types. I remember saying to when I finally like finalized this framework, I went running to my husband and I said, I just figured out that I'm part of this kind of like fringe extreme personality type. And he was like, you think? Because he was not surprised. So I'm an upholder. What are you?
Well, I was going to say, if you want to, do you want to guess what I am, what I would be?
Can I ask you a few questions?
Yeah, go ahead.
How do you feel about New Year's resolutions?
Yeah, I guess to some extent I do make them, but I also will just make resolutions at any given time, if it makes sense, I guess. I'm not like, it doesn't have to be January 1 for me.
Do you feel like you fit equally into all four tendencies? Can you see yourself in all the tendencies?
I feel like yes, actually. That's why the quiz was so hard for me, because I was like, oh, is this one, is that one? And our production team here actually kind of helped me with it. And in some cases, they're like, oh, well, if somebody tells you what to do, you definitely don't want to do it. But But then I was like, well, what they
do
all
they
make
think
sense.
You are? What do they think you are? Often do people around us have a very good sense of what they think our tendency is. Like if I talk to work groups, it's funny because people will start laughing and pointing to somebody they know because they know.
Yeah, is there an inner, either, what is the one with the most inner, I guess?
Where... Well, everybody faces outer and inner. Okay. No one can escape outer. It's okay. How do you meet an outer expectations pretty readily, or do you resist it until, so again, like if you're a questioner, if I asked you to do something, your answer would be, why should I?
That's what I
would say.
If you
were a rebel
yeah.
and I asked you to do something, you'd be like, you're not the boss of me.
Okay.
If I'm an obliger and I ask you to do something, they'll be like, okay. And if I'm an upholder, I'd be like, I'll do it unless I have something that's already on my books, in which case, yeah, I might have to tell you no because, yeah, your report is due tomorrow, but my report's due tomorrow too, so I'm afraid I can't help you. That's why upholders can sometimes seem cold. That's why obligers really are the rock of the world. I've had people tell me they only want to hire obligers because obligers are the ones that are the most willing to help out. They're the type O. They're the ones who pair up the most easily with the other three tendencies. And really the downsides of the obliger tendency fall most heavily on obligers because they get frustrated when they're meeting everyone else's expectations, needs, demands, but they're having trouble keeping their promises to themselves. And that's why the understanding that outer accountability is the missing piece is so powerful for obligers, because a lot of times they haven't understood what piece they need to put into their system in order to allow them to keep their promises themselves. And it's actually very straightforward. There's a million ways to create outer accountability. We're really good at that.
So I'm constantly researching and doing different studies and I'm in the investment industry, but I'm also researching happy retiree habits and early retiree habits. So I'm kind of always down that rabbit hole of finding out new things over and over and over again. So,
well, see, that goes to intellectual curiosity, which isn't what this is looking for. There are many crackpot questioners. There are many highly intellectual, research-based obligers. It's like, it's really like, how do you respond to expectations? So if I said to you, hey, do this, the question is, how would you respond to that? So something like your desire for adventure, or whether you're extroverted or introverted, how creative you are, those are really kind of beyond, they're sort of beside the point. They're not correlated with the tendencies.
Well, I ended up as a questioner, which...
Well, you said it, the quiz was really hard. That was my tip off, because that's often a questioner thing. Because they're like, I would act however made sense in a particular situation.
Yeah.
And that's how questioners approach the world.
All right. So how hardwired is this now? One, and two, can we change the tendencies, or we just have to kind of understand that that's how we are and then manage the tendencies?
Well, those are two super important questions. One is, I'm a big believer in the genetic roots of personality, and I really do believe that we bring the tendencies into the world with us. This is hardwired. It's not a product of birth order or culture or country or you know, anything like that. This is something that you bring into the world. However, your time, your culture, your experience is always going to influence the way this comes out. You're a questioner. If you were a questioner in North Korea, you would learn to shut that down. If you're a questioner in Silicon Valley, it could be your greatest asset. And with time and experience, we learn how to harness the strengths of our tendencies and how to offset the weaknesses and limitations of our tendencies. So for instance, sometimes people will say to me, well, I used to be an obliger, but now I'm an upholder. And I think, hold on, let's look at your life. And what I see is that you've figured out, you've intuited that you need outer accountability for anything that's important to you. And you've built that in so seamlessly that you don't even see that theme that you've created all this outer accountability. So you feel like an upholder, which is great. You've given yourself the accountability that you need. However, what can happen is some structure of accountability vanishes, and then the behavior may become a problem and you don't understand the crucial thing that's changed. So you're not able to easily fix it. Like my mother, who's an obliger, she went for a walk like every day practically for years because she would go on a walk with our neighbor. Then our neighbor moved away and my mother like didn't exercise again.
Oh,
for
she
years.
Stopped walking.
Yeah, because it was just, and it wasn't like she was like, now I'm going to stop walking. And if I said to her, I mean, this was before I came up with the tendencies, but if I'd said to her, do you think that's crucial? She would have been like, no, it just makes it more fun. I like chatting. Like, it's good to see this neighbor. But actually, that was the key thing. And if she'd known that, she could have easily replicated that in a myriad of ways. But she didn't understand that was the missing piece. Sometimes obligers will think, oh, I like social situations. And introverted obligers will be like, well, I don't like the idea of more social in my life, so I can't build outer accountability. But there's so many ways to create outer accountability that don't involve social engagement. Social engagement is an important form and often an enjoyable form of accountability, but is not essential for building accountability.
So, for instance, the gym, let's say, that charges you if you don't show up for a class, that would be somebody that would respond well to that would be what?
And okay, so that's a great example, because it gets in. You mentioned at the top about how we all have to do things that are in the way that's right for us. And one of the things that's interesting about everyone is that people see things differently. So even with the obligers, if you say, okay, this will be really good for obligers, some obligers are, and people generally are very motivated by losing money. If they paid for it, they're going to go. And that's a great system of accountability. However, I've spoken to obligers who are almost like, they feel like it lets them off the hook. They've paid, right? I talked to somebody who's like, oh, I signed up to work out with a trainer because I thought it would be important accountability. But then I realized, if I skip a session, he keeps the money and he gets the free time. And I was like, well, let me jump in and say, this is not working for you. Mm. So different people might need to experiment with different forms of accountability. For some people, something like an app sending a reminder would be enough. And other people, they're like, oh, I don't care about what some app says. That's not accountability. I need a different form of accountability.
So how do we think that it's fascinating to me, because so much of investing and planning for the future, which is really the theme here, retire sooner. How do we get to a point where we no longer financially have to work and we've got enough resources to do that? So much of it is the emotional side and the psychological side and the behavioral side of investing and growing wealth. And I guess the reason I think the tendencies to me are so fascinating is that it's another way for people to be better with money. So I guess I wanted to maybe shift towards, how do you see these? You know, if you're a rebel and you're listening today, or you're an upholder and you're listening to the Retire Sooner podcast, what would be your weaknesses in when it comes to money or investing or spending, anything in that category? Can you give our listeners some advice on that?
Well, upholders are easy. Basically, any tool works for upholders. They just need to have clarity on what they're expecting from themselves. So for them, it's like, give me the plan and I will execute on the plan. And the more specific, the better. Like, put it on the calendar, like have a dollar amount target, that kind of thing. Upholders, they take well to habit formation. And this is the thing, any kind of program, any curriculum, any app, anything is going to work well for some people, because basically anything like this works for upholders. Rebels are tricky.
Hold on. So hold on. So if I let's say, sort of identify everybody I talk to as, let's say, an upholder, I know that, hey, if we can get you a financial plan that's a 20-page plan, it's a specific goal, here it is, do this, they're going to be like all in all the time.
Yes.
Okay, love that.
That's the kind of thing that they're good at.
Rebel, though, how do you help a rebel?
Now, the thing is, rebels are the most misunderstood. They are the most different from the other three tendencies. And it's very, very helpful to know if you are a rebel or if you're dealing with a rebel, because what works for rebel is very different. So, for instance, accountability is crucial for obligers. It's often counterproductive for rebels. They don't like people looking over their shoulders or telling them what to do and having people check in on them. And so that can actually ignite their spirit of resistance. What works for rebels, one thing is identity. This is who I am. This is what I want. And they love freedom, choice, opportunity. And so it's sort of like, and they hate being trapped or constrained or told what to do. Yeah, you know what? They're trying to lock you into years of work by tempting you with all these fancy packages and impulse purchases, but you're free from all that. They can't control you. You see a life of opportunity. You have choices you can't even imagine. And what's going to get you to that place of freedom? Financial security. What do you want to do? Build that financial security. Can they trick you? Can they tempt you? No, they can't, because that's who you are. That's what you want. That's what you choose. Now, if you're working with a rebel, one thing that can happen is if you say, you need to do this, you should do this, you have to do this, you have to commit to this, they're like, no, I don't. So if you're dealing with a rebel, one thing to remember is that you want to present yourself as someone who is helping to execute what the rebel wants. If you want this, this could be helpful. If you want me to do this, I'm happy to do this for you, because I know this will help you. I am the servant of what you want. I'm not telling you what to do. Because that can ignite the spirit of resistance. Even if you're like, you hired me. Like, I'm doing this because this is what you want. It's like, ooh, you want to think of the language that is not going to make them that feeling like, I need the following documents from you by Friday. No.
It's, you know, more like, hey, if we want to get this accomplished, it would be great if you could get me that.
Yeah, if we could get this done by Q2, I think you'd see blah, blah, blah. You know, like, this is what you want. So also information, consequences, choice. Give them the information they need to make a smart decision. Tell them the consequences of their action or inaction, and then let them choose. So you can send a couple of emails saying, like, you know, I have to have this information by, you know, if this is going to be filed in a timely way, I have to have this information, blah, blah, blah. If we don't, the penalty is going to be 10%. Let me know if you need any kind of further assistance from me, like getting it all together. Information, consequences, choice. This is the information you need. This is the consequence of what happens. And then it's over to you. And you've got to make sure that you don't nag, you don't nudge, you don't remind too much. Now, in some situations, you want to send certain kind of like reminders or milestone things. But you want to make sure, because a lot of times, because we can so easily ignite the spirit of resistance and rebels, people who will have all the best intentions and love will actually impede the progress of rebels and make it hard for them. So, like, I talked to somebody who was trying to help somebody get a job. Like, her boyfriend was coming to live with her, and so he needed a new job. And she was like, well, he's really not going about it. What can I do to help? Should I make a list of phone numbers? Should I post something on the fridge? Should I say, hey, today's a great day to call your Uncle Bob? And I'm like, don't do anything. That guy knows he needs a job. And the more you remind him or nudge him or encourage him, you could ignite that spirit of resistance. And he's like, I'll do it when I'm ready. I'll do it in my own way, and slow him down. Often people around rebels make them slower at doing what they want to do because they ignite that spirit of resistance. This is easier said than done. Mm-hmm. But it's very important to understand they don't want to be told what to do. And if you tell them what to do, you can really
impede the progress.
You can impede the progress. So it's always, what do you want? What do you choose? Often they typically, like, they don't like to be locked into plans. Like, this is something that people around rebels be like, I know he loves this band. I think it'd be so fun to look forward to this concert. And yet, like, he keeps refusing to commit or, like, cancels at the last minute. I'm like, it's just rebel. It's not about your relationship. It's about the fact that rebels sometimes just, like, they just hate that feeling of, like, being trapped into a calendar. Mm. So a lot of it is like, hey, if you want to hang out this weekend, I'm free. So let me know if that works for you. Or, hey, I know we've been trying to catch up. I'm around this afternoon. So if you see a good window, feel free to just pick up the phone and call, rather than like, can we talk at 3:15 this afternoon?
Now, how about we're talking money habits here. What about the obliger, either from spending or investing? What does the obliger need to be better at a money habit, let's say?
Well, they need outer accountability. And so there's all kinds of ways that you could build outer accountability. Part of it, you can build accountability through relationships. And so I have to say, as an upholder, I don't think like this, because I'm like, I do it because that's what I want to do for myself. But obliger is often helpful to think about things like, I want to set an example for my family and my friends about what this kind of behavior looks like. Or I feel an obligation to my future self. Today, I don't feel like doing this, but I know that if I hit 65, I'm going to be really, really disappointed with myself if I haven't done it. So I have a duty to my future self. I have an obligation to the people around me to keep myself like healthy and solvent. And so I owe it to them. They may need to rely on me. I need to be prepared to pitch in if I need to. And that means that I need more of a cushion. There can be, there can be kind of like accountability groups where like, let's all commit to doing this. And like, let's cheer each other on. And every Sunday night, we're going to text each other and be like, I did it, or I didn't do it. Or, you know, and halfway through the week, we'll say, oh, I'm already done, or I still got to get it done. That kind of thing can be helpful. I've heard of funny things where, like, one family did this thing where they printed out a picture of a summer house by the beach and put it on the fridge. And they were like, if everybody does their part, we'll go for a week to a summer house. And if, you know, or whatever, or I heard about, this was funny. This is a woman who was studying for the bar exam. And she said, and she put the summer house picture up. This seems to be a common theme. And she said to everybody, if I pass the bar in the spring, we'll be able to go away for the summer. If I don't pass the bar, everybody's staying home this summer because I'm going to have to retake the bar and I'm going to be home studying. So, and everybody's like, all we want to do is help you pass the bar. Like,
please,
we're gonna
study.
Yeah,
please study.
We'll do the
don't
dishes.
Bother her.
We'll
yeah.
creep around. Like, you know, because this is, and so, but then she felt like, well, oh my gosh, I have to study hard. I really want to pass the bar because everybody's counting on me.
Inner and outer accountability, or mostly outer?
It's totally outer.
Oh, totally outer.
Look, inner accountability looks like this is really important to me. This is my priority. This is my priority. That's meeting an inner expectation. So that's upholder or questioner, because that's very powerful for both of them. I've made up my mind. This is the way I'm going to do it. And I'm just going to meet that expectation. It's on the calendar. I'm going to do it. I know that this is the best way for me to save money. I'm just going to execute on this plan. I will say that for questioners, it's very important. Trusted authority is very important. One of their questions is, why should I listen to you anyway? And they're not going to listen to you or do what you say if they don't trust your authority. So it's very important to anyone who's trying to work with questioners to establish that authority. And to often, even if you don't want to go through all the research and stuff yourself, you want to say, like, I could send you 10 links that will go through this in deeper. Or I could tell you a couple books that you could buy that will give you the framework that I think would be helpful. Like, information, research, authority, trust, belief that this is the right way. Because often when questioners don't follow through, it's because they haven't really committed to a system. They don't really have that inner conviction that this is the best and right way for them. And they must have that inner conviction to make something an inner expectation, which will then be executed. Otherwise, they're just stuck in this place of like, yeah, I don't know about that. Like, yeah, you got to, you know, I'm from Missouri, right? This is the show me state. And questioners are kind of like the show me tendency. You got to convince me. They're often told they ask too many questions. That's a thing questioners often complain about. People say they ask too many questions.
And I may be guilty of that sometimes. And here I am questioning you and asking you about everything.
This is a superpower of questioners. They're the ones who save us all from wasting our time, energy, and money on kind of nonsense.
So I'm always fascinated too. So we think about a huge part of the getting to retirement, just in general in America, right? We all know the statistics, less than 1 in 5 people in America can continue to kind of have the same lifestyle once they stop working. So just to be in that group at 65, 66 is a big deal. The Retire Sooner group is trying to do that even earlier. And I think I'm always fascinated about how many different ways people end up making a living. Yeah, it's always every time there's some real financial success story, it's always such a creative happenstance, and it's such a long journey which you've gone on, right? I mean, I remember hearing you say it was at one point Happiness Project. You were an overnight success that took 10 years.
Yes, yeah, it was my fourth book. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just want to talk about career and income and maybe entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
You think of yourself as a lawyer, but now you're an entrepreneur, right? I mean, that's how you.
Well, my core identity is as a writer, but I started my career in law. Yeah, I was clerking for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor when I decided to be a writer. That was an abrupt shift. And I certainly have become like an authorpreneur because for people in the book industry, like the people in so many industries, like we need to diversify our ways of engaging with an audience. We need to diversify our sources of income. And it's just exciting because for the kind of thing I do, it's really exciting and creative to think about using new tools. So I definitely do think about that and kind of think of approach my work in the way that an entrepreneur does. Yes.
How about your advice on maybe your best career advice about when it comes to either career or money or maybe your responsibility if you're sharing, if you're in a working family where you and your spouse works? What's your advice on somebody?
It's interesting
career?
Because having been a long student of happiness, I would say that money is one of the most complex and emotionally fraught areas. So you run into this every single day. It's not about the money. It's not about the facts. There's so much emotion in each person. And then you create a couple or you create a family and you've got this like boinging around in like, you know, like bonkers way. So it is very complicated. I think that when it comes to money, what is really helpful is clarity, because a lot of times our vision is clouded by what we don't know, what we're afraid to know, and that just gets in the way of us making choices. And so as much as you can, and there's all different kinds of strategies for that. You might say, okay, I'm going to spend a half an hour on this every day, because if I could do anything for a half an hour or maybe 15 minutes. But I know that I'm going to let myself off the hook. And if it takes a month, so be it. But I'm just going to like do it. You know, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? Mm-hmm. Or maybe as an obliger, it might help you to work with somebody like some kind of financial accountant or expert or advisor or coach or whatever somebody who's going to say, I need this, I need that, and kind of lead you through the process and hold you accountable for like certain kinds of information, hunting down certain kinds of things and help you make sense of it. It can be really helpful to just try to be honest about what's going on, to reflect on your past and how, you know, certain things may be resonating for you in a way that other people, it's sort of like, you see this often with kind of arguments about like frugality and lavishness, where it's like one person's like, you're spending so much, you're making me anxious. And someone else is like, your frugality is making me feel like pinched and cramped and like joyless. And so it's like, it's not that one person's right and one person's wrong. We often like devolve into these arguments about why I'm right and you're wrong. Or like, let's look at the numbers. It's more about like, this is how I feel, this is how you feel. How do we create an environment where we can both feel comfortable? How do we think about this? I think so often it's just like, I want to convince other people that I'm right, but they want to convince me that they're right. So, and that can be very frustrating. That can become a big source of conflict on its own, which just adds to the complexity of the whole situation. So I think that can like, trying to have a calm, when you're having a difficult conversation, research shows it often is helpful to hold hands. Because it's easier to stay calm and connected to somebody if you're holding hands. So you could just like hold hands. Another thing, somebody just told me this. I think this is hilarious. I cannot wait to do it. Is if you find yourself yelling, it's flash your armpits. That it's very hard to yell and like flash your armpits to somebody.
Plus I'd start laughing.
But that's the thing. You're like, what's going on here? I mean, I think it would kind of help you introduce like a moment of like levity and kind of absurdity to the whole thing. So I think that's a great solution. And often the obvious thing, like don't do it late at night. Don't do it when you're hungry. Don't do it when you have to be someplace in 20 minutes. Don't do it in the car. Don't do it like, this is the classic thing that I do, which is like I work at home and like I've got something on my mind and I want to cross it off my list. And the minute my husband walks in the door, I'm like, hey, we got to sit down and talk about this. And he's like, hey, I need to like chill out for a second. You know, it's like pick your moment. If you know it's going to be hard, pick the right time, because that can make it so much easier.
So money. So I like this thought of the happiness and money, the kind of the intersection for you is clarity around money and whatever that might be, depending upon what your tendency is.
Yeah.
I think that is it's a really powerful statement, is that everybody needs their own version of clarity, which is a really interesting thought actually. And I think about the folks that the younger folks that I've worked with, and I say younger and I say somebody in their 40s that's really aiming to be able to retire at like 55, which is, you know, somewhat unheard of, right? They want clarity on what do I need to do? What's the goal I need to get to? So I think that's interesting. The clarity, I see that working.
I think it's also more clarity, like what's your situation now? Mm-hmm. Like what are your assets? What are your debts?
Knowing where you are, as opposed to kind of ostrich head in the sand.
Yeah, because I think sometimes people are like, they don't even really know. And they may be comforted by finding out what they have, but you know, probably more often people are comforted or not comforted. Which is why they don't want to know. Sort of, you have to have that starting place of like, well, what is my situation? And given my situation now, what are the implications for the future that I want to attain?
So just a little bit of financial planning goes such a long way. Yes. Actually, a research point I had is that happy retirees spend at least 5 hours a year doing some sort of financial planning. Unhappy are significantly less than that. And that's not a lot. I mean, 5 hours a year is like nothing. It's like one or 2 hours on the weekend every quarter.
Yeah. I have a beautiful story like about that.
Yeah, let
so
me
a
hear
friend
it.
Of mine, ooh, who's a rebel and a big entrepreneur, he like created this whole online business. And he was telling me about a conversation, and it's all about finance, all about financial freedom, kind of in a different way. And he was telling me a conversation he had with his father. And his father was like a hardcore, true 70s hippie, like anti-consumerist, anti-materialist, like worked a bunch of odd jobs so he could travel, that kind of thing. Didn't really have any kind of
training. Vagabonding,
kind of like, but in a mindful, joyful way. And then he was older and he was over at my friend's house and they were like sitting on the sofa watching TV. And my friend said just randomly, like kind of just out of nowhere, he said to his father, who do you think thinks about money more, you or Warren Buffett? And his friend's father said in a second, me. I spent my whole life refusing to think about money, and now I can't think about anything else. It's all I think about.
That's a powerful story.
Yeah.
Because so he was really against worrying about it for all those years, and now it dominates his thought.
To your point, right?
Wow.
Exactly. 5 hours at 40.
Mm-hmm.
Could save
you a lifetime of worry,
or not a lifetime, but a lot of unpleasant intensity at the end.
Wow.
When it's kind of like, you know, like you said, a little planning goes a long way. A little, you know, compound interest is powerful. But one of my favorite phrases is the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
Yeah.
The best time to start a 529 is as soon as you can. The second best time is now. You know, a lot of these things, it's like there's the best time and then there's now. And now is always the right time.
So let me ask you that. You wrote an article that I loved about millennials and buying happiness. It was something like how millennials can buy happiness. And again, we know that we can't. Money doesn't necessarily buy happiness. The research I have shows that at a certain point, there's a real plateau effect, but we kind of need to get somewhere. What can millennials buy to increase their happiness? I love this topic.
Well, money can't buy happiness, but it can buy many things that contribute mightily to happiness. And as you mentioned, and as your whole, you know, enterprise suggests, like one of the most important things that money can buy is the freedom from worrying about money. Because money is like health. We are much more aware of them in the negative than in the positive. If you have your health, it's very hard to be grateful for your health, which is why people constantly kind of have to remind themselves not to take health for granted. Same thing with money. If you're paying your bills without sweat, you don't think about how precious that is. When you don't have money, when you're scraping for money, when you're worried about money, you're very aware. So it's much more present in the negative than in the positive. So not experiencing that negative is a big positive, but people kind of overlook it. Experience. It's interesting because a lot of times you'll see research saying, oh, experiences make people happier than possessions. But that's kind of like, I think, a false distinction, because often experiences imply possessions, or possessions imply experiences. So like, is having a fancy camera a possession or an experience? Is a dog a possession or an experience? Is a dining room table that means that you can invite your friends over all the time for dinner, is that a possession or an experience? So you have to think about, is this a possession that's gonna lead to happiness, engagement, fun with my friends, health? Or is this something, like if it's my 10th black cardigan, like that's not gonna move the needle.
Sure.
And it's different for different people, because like, let's say a really elaborate set of kitchen knives. Oh my gosh, those things can cost a lot of money if you like are buying the really high end stuff. If I cook all the time, if I love cooking, if it's a big part of my life and it brings me tremendous joy, a set of beautiful tools is such a joy. And I might use those every day and love them. I would feel proud and happy to see them on my counter. They would just give me like a little hits of joy every day. If I'm just like, oh, I want to impress people who come over to my house, let me buy this fancy set of kitchen knives and put it in the corner, I'll never notice it again. I won't notice it. They won't notice it. They'll just sit there gathering dust. They're a possession, but in different people's hands, they have different values. And so you want to say, well, I don't want to buy this thing just because everybody I know has this thing, or because other people would be impressed by this thing. Or maybe people tell me this thing is dumb to buy, but I know that I will truly enjoy it and get great pleasure out of it. And so I am going to buy it.
And then there's a lot of research that shows that there's some sort of inflection point or some plateauing. We get to kind of a certain amount more money in the beginning, maybe does a lot of buys us comfort, yep, and peace of mind. And then after a certain period of time, you know, 2 million versus 5 million, what's the difference, or 5 versus 10? What's your take on that?
I think the research, because money buys freedom. Money buys choices. Money buys flexibility. Money buys support. Money buys the ability to give and to support others. And to, you know, nothing like money could make you 10 on the happiness scale all the time. That's not how human nature works. That's not possible. That wouldn't even be a good life. So it's not like, well, at some point they're going to meet. Like, I'm going to have enough money that I'm perfectly happy. That's not how human nature works. We all know that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But could it be that as you have more money, you're more able to be healthy, you're more able to provide, you're more able to have freedom, you're less... One thing that the research shows, I'm sure you know, is that one of the things people don't like to do and that makes them unhappy is boring, repetitive chores and commutes. They don't like having to like schlep their laundry to the laundromat, and they don't like having to do a bad commute every day. So that's the kind of thing where it's not so much that there's money in your pocket, but you're like, oh, I'm not worried about the commute anymore because I have a difference. I could afford a really expensive apartment in the city, whatever. I don't want to make it sound like I think money is so important, but it is
an essential ingredient is what you're saying.
It allows you to make choices that support your happiness if you're wise. Now, if what you're spending your money on is drugs and, you know, gambling and, you know, I don't know, like suing your neighbors because for fun, because you think it's hilarious or whatever, which there's many cases of kind of like mischievous litigation because people just don't care. Or you just keep getting married and divorced because it doesn't matter to you, whatever. Mm-hmm. It can lead you in very, very negative directions if it's not spent wisely. So I would say money spent wisely can be an important factor in happiness, because spent wisely, it can help us achieve many of the things that bring happiness. Or like if I can, let's say I live in New York City, my parents live in Kansas City, I can go see them, not during COVID, but usually I could see them. If there was an important milestone, I could fly. My whole family could go for a visit. Like, it's not like I only get to see them once every 5 years because I can't afford that flight. That matters to me. That matters to my happiness. And so being able to show up, being able to go to a college reunion, being able to throw a party. These things matter to happiness because they matter to relationships. And relationships are probably the most important factor to happiness. And then there's relationships like our relationship to our community and to our society. If you felt like, oh, wow, I heard about this amazing food bank that's doing incredible work in my hometown. I want to like write a big check and I can do that. That makes me so happy, right? Because I'm supporting the people who are important to me because we share that hometown. That's important because it goes to relationships. It's not the fact of, oh, my bank account. It's like, now I can do this. I can do something that I value, that others will value, because I value relationships and I value other people.
All right. Quick lightning round here for a couple quick questions. Let's start with here's a spending question. What is the best thing that you've ever, and I call this PPUs, which are price per use.
I know the answer.
What is your number one PPU of all time?
It's a bandolier. So this is a thing that allows you to have your phone. It's a phone case that has a strap around it so you can wear it around your neck. And I travel, usually in usual times, I travel constantly. And my huge fear was like I would leave my phone on the counter at the newsstand, or I would leave it like on the seat beside me, or I'd leave it in a taxi, or leave it in I wouldn't leave it in my hotel room. I wouldn't be that dumb. But or I'm like walking around my apartment. It's like this thing you could do, or anytime like you're carrying a lot of bags or you need to keep checking your phone, like you're in an airport and you have to keep showing your boarding pass, whatever. This thing is just around my neck. Now, you have to be comfortable with the fact that you look like an idiot because you're wearing your phone around your neck, but I'm comfortable with that. Bandolier, everybody I know, I try to get them to get them. They're so amazing.
Number one PPU. All right. Yeah. So what do you splurge on? Spending.
Perfume. I really, really do love perfume, and it's ridiculously overpriced.
You have a favorite, or you have like a bunch of favorites?
I have like 11 favorites. It's very hard to find. One thing that's good about my splurge is it's very hard to find a perfume that I love. And so I don't often get the opportunity to splurge. But if I find one that I love, I will buy it, even if it's very expensive.
So core pursuits are my version of hobbies on steroids. They're very important to you. They're something. It's not like a once in a while thing. It's like my life is this. Yeah. What is one core pursuit for you that you can't give up? If you had to give up every other one?
Reading. Yeah.
Number one core pursuit. Best investment ever. Worst investment ever.
I don't know. Okay. Markets go up. Markets go down.
No. Okay. Yeah, that's true.
No, best investment in my health. Oh, strength training. I do high intensity strength training. My whole family now, my in-laws, my parents, my sister, like 100 of my friends, because it just totally changed my body. It does so much for both my children do it. I mean, so that's an investment in my health, and I'm not a big exercise. I go for walks, but I'm not like playing tennis or skiing or anything. So that's really important for me.
On your podcast, the Happier with Gretchen Rubin, I love your little happiers.
Oh, I'm so glad you like those.
There was one you did. I don't know if it was your daughter or somebody you were saying, it was like, it was something about, again, you mentioned relationships are kind of number one thing in happiness, which is awesome. And it was some sort of counsel you gave her on just being sociable. It was like some advice on that. What was that? Can you tell our audience about that?
This is when my daughter was very little and she wasn't very good about making conversation with children she didn't know. And so my husband and I were sort of trying to coach her. And I said to her, well, you could say things like, well, what's your favorite color? Or what's your favorite thing to do at school? Or what movies do you like? And she looked at me very skeptically and she said, I like it when other people say those things to me. And I was like, and we both were just like, oh, honey, we like it when people say those things to us, too. That is a lot easier. But we all have to try. We all have to make the effort. And I just thought that was so funny. We talk about that all the time to this day. It's like, you got to ask her, what's her favorite color? You know?
All right. Well, that'll be my last question. What's your favorite book that you've written?
That I've written? Mm-hmm. It's always the book that I'm writing now. I always think that's my favorite book. Right now I'm writing a book about the five senses, and it's such a delight. It's so much fun. I love this more than anything. But I feel that way about every book.
So everyone is just a special one while you're doing it.
While I'm doing it, I just think it's never going to be this good again.
God. Yeah, I know that feeling, I can tell you. So, and then will you come be our, I was going to ask you, will you come be our in-house our in-house psychological money expert here is what I want. It's really what I need you to do.
Okay, yeah. Well, my sister calls me a happiness bully, so maybe that's a good good credential for that job.
All right. Well, welcome to the Retire Sooner podcast, Gretchen Rubin. Such a so cool to be able to talk with you and get your advice, and particularly kind of your thoughts on money and early retirement and money and happiness. It's a real honor to have you on. Big time.
Well, thanks so much. I so enjoyed our conversation.
You can find Gretchen at GretchenRubin.com. All of her social media is on GretchenRubin.com, and her Four Tendencies quiz, which over 3 million people have taken. The Four Tendencies quiz is right on GretchenRubin.com. And something new that Gretchen's offering is her SMS courses. And I said, what is SMS? It's really these 30-day text courses where you're going to text and do a variety of different courses that focus on relationships, put together by Gretchen and her team.